I'd like to begin with a reading, though, and it's from Joseph Campbell in The Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. Perhaps some of you remember that from years ago. You can tell what's informing a society by what the tallest building is. When you approach a medieval town, the cathedral is the tallest thing in the place. When you approach an 18th century town, it is the political palace that's the tallest thing in the place. And when you approach a modern city, the tallest places are the office buildings, the centers of economic life. If you go to Salt Lake City, you see the whole thing illustrated right in front of your face. First, the temple was built right in the center of the city. This is the proper organization because the temple is the spiritual center from which everything flows in all directions. Then the political building, the Capitol, was built beside it, and it's taller than the temple. And now the tallest thing is the office building that takes care of the affairs both of the temple and the political building. That's the history of Western civilization. And just make this point, of Western civilization, not the world. From the Gothic through the princely periods of the 16th century, 17th century, 18th century, to this economic world that we're in now. Society created religion because we need a social heart, a commonly held set of values defining how we should relate. Without such a defining heart, there is no code, no system of community justice, no bonding of social life. There is only the excesses of self-centered individualism. The fact that religion has become an impotent institution in Western culture is not due to a change in its purpose or necessity. It is because religion has failed to speak and to model a message which is relevant to present human need. I believe that we Unitarian Universalists fall under this judgment. Otherwise, we would see our values reflected in the social heartbeat. Now, there was a time in American history when Unitarian Universalists did provide the social heartbeat. It was during the latter part of the 1700s and the first part of the 1800s. This was the time when our values provided the ideology which birthed our nation and shaped our Constitution. However, for a variety of reasons, which is a whole nother sermon, our heartbeat grew faint, and it was replaced by the stronger one of conservative Christianity. During the Second World War in the 1950s, it appeared that Christianity had forever won the nation's heart. This proved to be an illusion, for what appeared to be a strong heartbeat was the result of a temporary shot of social adrenaline. This made Christianity's heart to appear stronger than it actually was. That adrenaline was a nation's sense of gratitude to Christianity's God for enabling us to win the Second World War. But underneath this surface, the surface of this illusion, a new set of values were emerging, which would become the heartbeat of American culture. The Vietnam War provided the occasion for its rise to dominance. With the Reagan presidency, it reigned supreme as the moral heart of our nation, and still is. This new heartbeat has not come to us under the guise of religion, although it has usurped the role of religion because of the impotence of religion. Its face is the American corporation. Its fundamental philosophy is geared to its definition of human worth. In a general sense, human worth is defined by social and economic status. In a specific sense, human worth is defined by contribution to the gross national product. Why am I sharing these perceptions? Because I believe, despite our proclamation of principles that stand against this corporate model, we have been giving ourselves permission for some time to be subtly co-opted in our community life by the corporate model of our culture. It began with the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, of which I grew up in, which ushered in a furious negative reaction to religion. In our churches, the ground of this reaction was our confusion that being religious and being orthodox were the same. We began purging ourselves of all things which reminded us of religion, language, ritual, financial stewardship, and even those principles which govern all institutional success, simply because they were used by the Orthodox. But above all else, we converted our religious purpose into a self-serving internal goal, that of creating fellowship for frustrated liberals. And we're still stuck in that. Anytime one of our congregations took a membership survey to rank its values, you always knew what the top value would be. The word at the top of the list would be what? Take a guess. Fellowship. And it still is. And we're going to be putting together, you know, searching for the minister and doing that survey. To protect this fellowship from the encroachment of new members, we began debating about limiting the size of our memberships. Nobody ever debates that if we're invested in our purpose. Size is not an issue. To emphasize a sanctuary posture, many of our congregations constructed or purchased buildings in the woods, old houses that didn't look like churches, or any place else that they might be hidden from public view. We began to exist for the sake of ourselves. Whatever message we had was about who we were not rather than who we were. We practice a thought theology of negation. In other words, what I mean by that is when someone asks you, what do you believe, we almost, it's in our nature, we'll tell people what we don't believe. And then they ask, well, what do you really believe? And there's a pause. So we preferred to be socially respectable rather than to be religious. With this conversion of our purpose, we turned to the corporate model to organize ourselves. We adopted its cost-effective language. Institutional maintenance replaced our daring of vision. We imported the super-rational approach to reality, and the mystery of life became hidden to our eyes. Clergy often viewed themselves as chief executive officers. And now it's written into our contracts. In short, we have traded the religious model with its collective focus and generosity of spirit for the corporate model with its individualized focus and self-centered spirit. For if we are modeling the secular mentalities with which people must contend with in the rest of our culture, what appeal is that? The power to transform the social heart lies in two areas. First, in proclaiming a message relevant to current human needs. Second, in modeling how that message works in community living. If the relevant need is for a different way of relating than that offered by the corporate model of our culture, then the message we model must be different than the secular one. I believe if we are to truly model the religious principles we proclaim, the visible characteristics of our community living would correspond to these commitments. One, a commitment to the equal worth of every member, irrespective of economic and social status. Two, a commitment to the ecological principle that what's best for the whole is the same as what's best for the part. That's a bit of a swipe at our ardent individualism, isn't it? Three, a commitment to the democratic process as the only fair and equal way of making community decisions. Four, a commitment to religious purpose as the only valid measure of the success or failure of the congregation's ministry. Five, a commitment to the belief that power shared is power multiplied. And last, a commitment to a profound form of mutual trust between congregation and minister. Think about the transforming power of this kind of community model. Think about its appeal to people who must contend with the corporate heartbeat. The purpose of this kind of community model is to create behavior which makes our congregations a different place to be than in the secular world. That's it in a nutshell. If we are to become a different place to be in the world, then we must live our message in such a manner that we dramatically and profoundly affect each other. Let me illustrate with a story. There was a famous monastery that had fallen on hard times. Once its many buildings were filled with young monks and its big church resounded with the singing of chants, but now it was deserted. People no longer came to be nourished by its spiritual power. Only a handful of old monks shuffled through its cloisters with heavy hearts. Now, on the edge of the woods by the monastery, an old rabbi built a little hut. He would come there occasionally to fast and pray. No one ever spoke to the rabbi, but whenever he appeared, the word would pass from monk to monk, "The rabbi walks in the woods." As long as he was there, the monks would be sustained by his presence. Now, one day, the abbot decided to visit the rabbi and open his heart to him. As he approached the hut, he saw the rabbi standing in the doorway, his arms outreached in welcome. It was as though he had been waiting. The two embraced like long-lost brothers. The rabbi motioned for the abbot to enter. In the middle of the room was a table with the scriptures opened upon it. Then the rabbi lifted his head and said, "You and your brothers are serving with heavy hearts, and you have come to ask me of a teaching. I will give you a teaching, but you can only repeat it one time. After that, no one must ever repeat it aloud again." The rabbi looked into the abbot's eyes and said, "The Messiah is among you." For a while they were silent, then the rabbi said, "You must go." Next morning, the abbot gathered his monks and told them he had received a teaching from the rabbi who walks in the woods. He said that the teaching must never again be spoken aloud. Then he looked at each of his brothers and said, "Rabbi said that one of us is the Messiah." Well, the monks were startled by this teaching. What could it mean, they asked themselves. Is Brother John the Messiah, or Brother Matthew, or Brother Thomas? Am I the Messiah? What could this mean? They were all deeply troubled by the rabbi's teaching, but no one ever mentioned it again. As time went by, the monks began to treat one another with a very special reverence. There was a gentle, wholehearted quality about them now, which was hard to describe but easy to notice. They lived with one another as men who had finally found something, yet they prayed as men who were still searching. Visitors often found themselves deeply moved by the life of these monks, and before long, people were coming from far and wide to be nourished by this spiritual practice. Young men were asking once again to become part of the community. That's out of Scott Peck, by the way. Dear First U of Chicago, take courage, be glad, a unique and grand opportunity is before us. For the transforming power of this kind of community shall leave us standing on the side of love. And Hyde Park in Chicago needs some more people to stand on the side of love. Why not it be us? Amen and blessed be. Our benediction is from our own Walt Whitman, considered in literature the poet, the best poet in America. You shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and the sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on specters and books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself.